content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 23rd, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows President Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan standing in the foreground with a Capitol building back behind them. The sky's kind of cloudy. In between them and in front of them is a big pile of bundles of bills that's on fire. And they're holding a flag, a yellow flag, between them with a snake on it that says, or did say, "Don't tread on me." The headline is, "Hey, Big Spenders, How the GOP Learned to Love Trillion-Dollar Deficits." So let's take the main stories and how they were covered. The quest for an immigration deal. What happened? The state's immigration debate got off to an unpromising start this week, with both sides laying the groundwork for blaming each other if they fail to reach a compromise. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell agreed to hold a rare open floor debate after Democrats forced a brief government shutdown last month over the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Back in September, President Trump canceled DACA, an Obama-era scheme protecting from deportation 700,000 so-called dreamers brought to the U.S. illegally as children. He gave Congress until March 5th to negotiate a permanent solution. But having initially promised he'd sign any bipartisan compromise bill lawmakers sent him, Trump this week warned he would veto legislation that didn't include the four pillars of his own immigration proposal: giving dreamers a path to citizenship, scrapping the diversity visa lottery that brings in 50,000 people a year, $25 billion for a southern border wall, and a sharp reduction in legal immigration for new citizens' family members, which opponents call chain migration. Democrats, who strongly oppose curbing legal immigration, rejected the White House plan. But as the week went to press, it was unclear whether any of the other bipartisan proposals, which traded protections for Dreamers for limited funding for border security and the wall, would secure the 60 Senate votes required for passage or have any chance of passing in the more conservative House. Senator Lindsey Graham said the only hope was for a compromise that would provide wall funding but not affect legal immigration. "The consensus is to have big border security and big DACA," Graham said. "It would be a two-pillar bill." What the editorial said: the stakes in the DACA debate could not be higher, said the Washington Post. If the program expires, 1,000 law-abiding dreamers will lose their protections and work permits every single day. That's 7,000 each week, 30,000 each month, more than 350,000 in the first year. Trump's so-called compromise, with its slew of hardline restrictionist measures, was never going to receive the necessary 60 votes in the Senate. But even if senators do forge a bipartisan deal, House Speaker Paul Ryan said last week he'd only bring a bill to the floor if it had the backing of the president. That doesn't bode well. "Will Congress ever stop this perpetual punting game on immigration?" said St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Democrats gave away their leverage by agreeing last week's budget deal and removing the threat of a government shutdown. Republicans no longer have any reason to yield their hard line. In fact, GOP lawmakers face pressure not to give Dreamers a path to citizenship because it would allow potential primary opponents to label them pro-amnesty. what the columnist said. The president is nursing a potentially shrewd strategy, said Jeremy Carl in NationalReview.com. Trump offered Democrats a generous deal. His proposal would legalize all 1.1 million eligible DACA recipients, not just the 700,000 who signed up, knowing full well they'd reject it because of the curbs on legal immigration. Trump is exposing the Democrats as extremists who'd rather let dreamers go unprotected than accept any limits on immigration. But Democrats are also playing the long game, said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com. Their moral calculus is that dreamers will be far better off if Democrats take the House and Senate this fall, and that forcing an unpopular government shutdown would have made that less likely. If there is now no deal, keeping the dreamer question unanswered will give the party a big campaign issue in November. Immigration advocates will be furious, but they won't exactly have another place to turn. Everyone has agreed to pretend that Trump cares about the dreamers, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. Republicans adopt this posture because polls show that DACA recipients are highly sympathetic figures. Democrats because it helps pressure the president into a deal. The reality, of course, is that Trump created this crisis himself by killing DACA and has since sabotaged every effort to fix it, all to get a hardline immigration policy and his wall. But if there's no deal and the Trump administration starts deporting dreamers, the ruse will be up and the president will bear the political cost. Our controversy of the week. Spending. How Republicans learned to love deficits. During the Obama presidency, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com, conservatives outraged by deficit spending launched the Tea Party movement to demand fiscal restraint. But now that Republicans have gained full control of the federal government, they have chosen to repeal the Tea Party. House Speaker Paul Ryan, President Trump, and other Republicans last week agreed with Democrats to blow up the budgetary spending caps that were the main legacy of the Tea Party movement, agreeing on a two-year spending binge that will force the U.S. to borrow $955 billion this year, nearly double last year's $519 billion, and $1.15 trillion in 2019. Democrats get an increase in domestic spending from $539 billion to $591 billion, and Republicans get an equivalent bump in military spending from $634 billion to $700 billion. With no Democrat in the White House, said Catherine Rample in WashingtonPost.com, Republicans have learned to love deficits. But their flip-flop is breathtakingly ill-timed. We're in the ninth year of an economic recovery and should be paying down the debt we accrued during the recession. For Republicans to be boosting spending now, at the same time Trump's ginormous plutocratic tax cut sharply reduces federal revenues, is extremely reckless. Republican priorities have changed, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Under Trump, Republicans are pursuing their sincerely held small government goals through regulatory reform, cutting red tape and bureaucracy, and by reducing taxes on businesses. That's all well and good, but unless they want trillion-dollar deficits forever, Republicans need to face reality and either make big cuts in spending or raise taxes to the vicinity of Sweden's 60% rate. As Republicans well know, there is no public appetite for massive cuts in Social Security, Medicare, or other safety net spending, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. if we want big government, we have to pay for it. So why did Republicans just cut taxes by $1.5 trillion, mostly for the wealthiest Americans? Don't blame Trump alone, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. This is what Republicans always do when they occupy the White House. Under Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, Republicans cut taxes for the rich and spent like drunken sailors. The moment Democrats regained power, Republicans howled about the crushing burden of debt and used it as a pretext to obstruct the Democratic president's agenda. Republicans never really cared about debt and deficits, said Paul Krugman in NYTimes.com. The proof? They just voted more stimulus to an economy with 4% unemployment than they were willing to allow an economy with 8% unemployment in 2009. The only explanation for this fiscal madness is that a Republican now sits in the White House. Democrats aren't blameless for this new era of big spending, said Russell Berman in TheAtlantic.com. Yes, they secured billions for important programs, including children's health insurance and the opioid crisis. But the whole challenge of two-party politics is to set priorities for finite funding. Right now, the parties are simply cracking open the federal piggy bank and divvying up the spoils to further their separate agendas. No doubt about it, the Tea Party is dead, said former Tea Party leader Matt Kibbe in Reason.com. Trump and his followers don't care about deficits, and neither do the cynical Republicans running Congress. That means it's trillion-dollar deficits and red ink as far as the eye can see. Well, it was a good week for job seekers after a study found that more than one in three staffers in the Trump White House left their positions in the first year. The 34% departure rate is more than triple President Obama's. It was a good week for financial incentives after a Philadelphia elementary school offered eighth graders $100 not to fight. So far, the experiment is working. I was always trying to fight somebody, said student Zakiya Barnes-Wiggins. But now I don't use my hands. And it was a good week for karma when a suspected lion poacher with a rifle was killed and eaten by lions at a private game park in South Africa. The irritated lions ate his body, nearly all of it, and just left his head and some remains, the police said. But it was a bad week for living the dream when a Colorado couple with little sailing experience quit their jobs, bought a 28-foot sailboat for a trip around the world, and sank it within sight of land shortly after leaving Florida. Tanner Broadwell, 26, and Nikki Walsh, 24, say they'll try again when they save some money. It was a bad week for family dinners after the parents of Kevin Nicholson, Wisconsin's Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, both sent maximum contributions to his Democratic opponent, Senator Tammy Baldwin. My parents have a different worldview than I do, Nicholson explained. And it was a bad week for stubbornness after a suspected drug smuggler in Britain swallowed several packets just before his arrest and has refused to move his bowels for 26 days. Lamar Chambers doesn't seem to understand that eventually he will need or have to go, the police said. And another one of those little boring but important articles that show up next to this feature. White House blocks Democratic memo. President Trump last week refused to release a classified memo by House Democrats written to rebut Republican allegations that the FBI abused its surveillance powers to spy on a Trump campaign advisor's contacts with Russia. The White House said the Democratic memo contained too much classified information. Trump had released an earlier GOP memo without redactions, despite objections from the head of the FBI that the memo was deliberately misleading. The Republican memo claimed that in seeking a warrant to surveil Trump aide Carter Page, the FBI didn't tell a judge that some of their intelligence came from a dossier funded by Democrats. The Democratic memo reportedly details many reasons the FBI saw Page as a tool of Russia. On the briefing page now, the battle over chain migration. President Trump wants to limit family-based immigration as part of an overall reform of the system. Why? What is chain migration? The term itself remains a point of heated contention. Formerly known as family reunification, it's the process by which U.S. citizens and green card holders can sponsor their relatives to come and live here, too. In 2016, 805,000 of the 1.1 million people who legally entered the U.S. came in via a family member, with Mexico, the Philippines, and China leading the list of feeder countries. For advocates, family-based immigration has been a cornerstone of the U.S. entry system for decades and part and parcel of the American dream. President Trump and other immigration restrictionists contend that chain migration, as they prefer to call it, is responsible for a flood of distant relations and dependents entering the country, regardless of their qualifications. Chain migration is a total disaster, said Trump in January, calling for a move to a merit-based system. It threatens our security and our economy and provides a gateway for terrorism. Which relatives can come in? Trump has contended that a single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. But that's not really true. Under the 1965 Immigration Act, immigrants who have gone through the five-year process of becoming a U.S. citizen can petition for spouses, parents, siblings, and children to join them, while green card holders can sponsor only spouses and unmarried children. Cousins, uncles, aunts, and grandparents can't be sponsored. In addition, sponsorships of people who aren't parents, children, or spouses are subject to strict numerical caps, including a limit of 25,620 per country each year, which is why Mexicans and Filipinos now have an average wait of about 25 years for a visa. For many other countries, the wait is longer than 10 years. Under the current system, says immigration attorney David Leopold, it's easier for that person to get a degree in higher education and come in on an employment-based visa. Applicants also have to pass various standards for entry. What are the standards? Sponsors have to prove that their annual household income is 125% of the poverty line, at least $20,300 for a two-person household, and show that they can support their family member without government aid. Every visa applicant also has to go through a criminal and terrorism background check. Trump has repeatedly connected chain migration to two terrorist attacks last year, both in New York City. The first, a truck attack on a Manhattan bike path, was carried out by Saifullo Saipov, who actually came over from Uzbekistan via the Diversity Visa Program. The second suspect, attempted subway bomber Akied Ullah, moved over from Bangladesh via a family member. Authorities say both Saipov and Ullah passed all the necessary security checks and were radicalized after they got here. Since 1975, a total of 16 people have been murdered in attacks on U.S. soil by terrorists who entered on a family-based green card, according to a study by the Cato Institute's Alex Nowratesh. During that time, 35 million people came into the country through green cards. What about the benefits? Advocates say that America was built on family-based immigration. With previous waves of Italian, Irish, German, Jewish, Polish, and other immigrants bringing over family members once they got a foothold in America. Those relatives help them settle in their communities, start family businesses, and contribute to the national economy. Today, many take low-paid jobs in the food service and healthcare industries, but nearly half of diversity visa and family-based immigrants hold college or graduate degrees, making them better educated than the average U.S.-born American. The president himself wouldn't be here without family migration. Trump's paternal grandfather, Friedrich Trump, immigrated to New York in 1885 to join his oldest sister. The president's mother followed her sister from Scotland in 1930. Donald Trump is a product of chain migration, says Columbia University historian Mai M. Guy. Trump's wife, Melania, is an immigrant from Slovenia whose parents followed her to the U.S. What did the critics say? Restrictionists say the situation has gotten out of hand. The foreign-born population of the U.S. has quadrupled since 1970. Immigrants who arrived from 1981 to 2000 sponsored an average of 1.77 relatives to join them, but the most recent are sponsoring an average of 3.46, according to the Center for Immigration Studies, CIS. The current system takes away the immigration decision from policymakers and privatizes it to the individuals that yesterday were immigrants, said Mark Krikorian, executive director of CIS, which favors strict limits on immigration. What has Trump proposed? As part of a broader package that includes a border wall and a path to citizenship for 1.8 million Dreamers, or children who were illegally brought to the U.S., Trump wants to limit sponsorship to the nuclear family, that is, to spouses and children under 21 only. But even if Congress did pass much tighter restrictions on families, authorities would still have to process the nearly 4 million people already on the waiting list. That would take more than a decade, says Ira Melman, media director for the Conservative Federation for American Immigration Reform. And Democrats will use every minute of those 10 years to get those immigrants back, piece by piece. What's in a name? Amnesty? Dreamers? Anchor Baby? The immigration debate has become a war of words as both sides seek to frame the issue with terms that shape perceptions and drive popular opinion. Trump has successfully weaponized chain migration, which in 2016 was used zero times on Fox News. In 2017, it appeared 295 times, according to the Media Matters. But many liberals refuse to use it, claiming that it is demeaning and racist. They contend the phrase, which academic experts on immigration used neutrally in the 1960s, has been appropriated by white supremacists and alt-righters to depict an endless chain of Mexicans, Asians, and other foreigners streaming into the country, threatening America's culture and white majority status. I remember days when chain migration was a niche topic, white nationalist Travis Hale recently tweeted. Trump isn't perfect, but be thankful. moving into the best columns of the week now. We'll take two from the U.S. First, how China pays Trump millions. The Chinese government is paying Donald Trump $2 million a year, said Dan Alexander and Matt Drange. In a conflict of interest unprecedented in American history, Trump's family business is leasing the 20th floor of Trump Tower in Manhattan to China's state-run bank. That would appear to be an obvious violation of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which prohibits the president from receiving payments from foreign governments. Our investigation reveals that Trump receives $175 million a year in rent from commercial tenants of his project properties, and the president refuses to disclose who those tenants are. Many of them, we discovered, are businesses that can be affected by federal government decisions. One is Walgreens Boots Alliance, which pays Trump $3.2 million a year in rent and just got his administration's approval to buy rival Rite Aid stores after the Obama administration blocked a merger on antitrust grounds. Bank of America, Barclays, and numerous other banks that benefit from the administration's major deregulation efforts also pay Trump millions in rent. How can Americans trust that Trump's personal interests don't influence his policies? He refused to divest himself from his businesses, so we are simply left to wonder. The campus takeover of our culture. Whenever I bemoan the culture of safe spaces and microaggressions on college campuses, said Andrew Sullivan, people argue that the real world isn't like that. But that's no longer true. More and more of our public discourse is now shaped by the neo-Marxist left's identity-based social justice worldview, in which all interactions are defined by a hierarchy of power and oppression. Free speech itself is falling into disrepute as a tool of the patriarchy. When some feminist recently got wind of a forthcoming Harper's essay criticizing the Me Too movement, they not only personally vilified author Katie Roifa, they also tried to force the magazine to drop the piece before publication. A real-world echo of students shouting down speakers. Writers, like students, now know that one incorrect opinion on sensitive issues of race and gender can result in instant social ostracism and demands they be fired. So they remain silent. Men cannot discuss sexual harassment. Whites cannot talk about racism. The goal of our society is not the emancipation of the individual, but permanent placement of the individual in the proper identity group. White, black, brown, female, gay, etc. We used to call that bigotry. Now we call it being woke. This from Brazil, a carnival of violence on Rio's streets. Rio de Janeiro has become a war zone, said O Globo. The main thoroughfare known as the Yellow Line had to be closed four times in a single day last month because of gun battles between military police and drug traffickers. Three people died in the violence, and cell phones captured scenes of terror among drivers and passengers, with mothers and children running to protest, protect themselves from the shots, and police using private cars as barricades. By the next day, those viral images were already old news because the Yellow Line was closed again by yet another shootout. At one point, all three of Rio's main expressways were shut because of police operations. Innocents too often end up as casualties of crossfire. Jeremiah Moraes da Silva, 13, was walking home in a favela after playing soccer last week when a shootout erupted between police and gang members. He was killed by a stray bullet. The same day, 3-year-old Emily Sofia Neves Mariel was fatally shot by thugs who opened fire on her family's car. Not just the city, but also the state of Rio is clearly adrift. Governor Luis Fernando Pessoa says he is outraged and laments that this is not the city we want. But this violence is not his fault. Only federal help can prevent another Jeremias or Emily. it's time for the last word, our in-depth article. This week, the title is The Search for a Better Way to Die. Dying well in a planned and personalized way has become a trendy fixation, said journalist Marissa Meltzer. That might explain the increasing popularity of the Swedish practice known as death cleaning. Last spring, at Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, where the artist Jean-Michel Bacay is buried, another conceptual artist, Sophie Kahl, launched an installation called Here Lies the Secrets of the Visitors of Greenwood Cemetery. For the next 25 years, anyone passing by will be able to write down their most intimate secrets and bury them in a grave designed by the artist. The cemetery also hosts moonlit tours, cocktail parties, dance performances, and even yoga classes. Death is hot right now, and upbeat gatherings in cemeteries are just a small part of the trend. One of the chief desires of our time is to turn everything we touch into a reflection of who we are, how we live, and how we want others to view us. And death is no exception. Once merely the inevitable, death has become a new bourgeois rite of passage that, much like weddings or births, must now be minutely planned and personalized. If you fancy an environmentally friendly burial, you can choose to be wrapped in a biodegradable artisanal shroud, decorated to your specifications by the bespoke company Veil for $545. It's just $68 for pets. Or you can be buried, as the celebrated California chef Alice Waters says she wants to, in a burial pajama suit seeded with mushrooms that help your body decompose more quickly. For people more worried about the terrifying prospect of dying alone, there are now solutions. You can hire a death doula, a trained professional who will assist at the end of life in the same catch-all manner that birth doulas are there during labor. You can request a home funeral in which your friends and family pay their respects to your corpse in the comfort of your living room. And before that day arrives, you can discuss the facts of death with like-minded souls at a death cafe, a meeting of the global movement started in 2011 by John Underwood, who died last summer of acute promyelocytic leukemia, as a way for people to gather and reflect on mortality. One of the people pioneering this new way of approaching death is Caitlin Doughty, a young Los Angeles-based mortician who looks like a lost member of the Addams family. She has written a best-selling memoir, hosts a YouTube series called Ask a Mortician, and has founded a death acceptance collective called the Order of the Good Death, whose youthful members promote positive approaches to mortality. It's okay to be openly interested in death practices, Doughty told me while driving through L.A. one afternoon last autumn. It makes you an engaged human who cares about all aspects of life. This growing interest in alternative death practices began as a way to skirt the commercialism and uniformity of the funeral industry, and it appeals to a diverse set of people. The desire for a pine box in the ground brings together hippies and libertarians, stay-off-my-land gun owners, certain religious people, Trump voters who don't want big business ignoring what they want, Doughty said. They might not all have the same back-to-earth vision, but it's the same fight for their fundamental rights. They don't want a planned corporate infrastructure to dictate what happens to their mortal remains and what represents their life. Given that the idea of rethinking death connects with millions of people who are tired of the rampant commercialism and homogeneity of modern life, it was only a matter of time before commercial interests caught on. Just as the Danish concept of hag was sold in the form of scented candles and hand-knitted woolen socks to consumers looking for comfort in troubled times, there is gold, too, in our obsession with a good death. Publishers, in particular, have latched onto the trend. Last year saw the arrival of a stack of literary memoirs about death by authors such as Edwidge Danticat and Robert McCrum. In his memoir, My Father's Wake, the writer Kevin Tulis explains why the Irish get death right, while Caitlin Doughty's new book, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death, explores the way cultures from Indonesia to Bolivia to Japan approach death. But perhaps it's not the Irish or the Bolivians who have perfected the art of dying well, but the Swedish. In recent months, thanks to a publisher-led media campaign, you may have come across the concept of duschdängning, the Swedish practice of death cleaning. Death cleaning applies a simple formula to the process of dealing with our possessions before we die. In Marie Kondo's The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying, a best-selling guide to tidying up your home, and thus your life, the essential question is whether a given object sparks joy. In death cleaning, it is, will anyone I know be happier if I save this? It is easy to see the appeal. Death cleaning addresses many of the aspects of contemporary life that make us most anxious. For those who feel that they have accumulated too much stuff and that all this stuff is getting in the way of their spiritual development, it offers a practical guide to decluttering. For those who worry about their privacy or the prospect of relatives discovering their secrets, it offers sensible precautions. For those who fear a long, bewildered, incapacitated old age, it is a way of coping through clear-eyed preparation and understanding. A friend of mine who works as a radio producer in Stockholm said, "My mother is duschdängning incarnated. She has been in the mode of frenetic cleaning for a couple of years now. She is 65 and thinks throwing stuff out will make it easier for us children when she is no longer with us. She doesn't want us to be left with difficult decisions about what to do with it, and she doesn't want personal stuff to get in the wrong hands. The well-funded Swedish welfare state enables elderly Swedes to live independently. Perhaps this also adds to the sense that they feel they must get their things in order before they die, so that no one else should be responsible for it," says Michael Booth, the author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, a cultural tour of Scandinavian countries. The book responsible for spreading the death cleaning gospel is by Margareta Magnusson, a Swedish artist who describes herself as between 80 and 100. The Gentle Art of Swedish Death Cleaning, How to Free Yourself and Your Family from a Lifetime of Clutter, came out in English a few months ago. It is part practical guide to getting your affairs in order, part discourse on accepting the reality of death. Over the course of 38 very short chapters with titles such as If It Was Your Secret, Then Keep It That Way, or How to Death Clean Hidden, Dangerous and Secret Things, Magnusson sets out her pragmatic and upbeat approach to mortality. Life will become more pleasant and comfortable if we get rid of some of the abundance, she writes. The message was, we just have to accept that one day we will die, said her literary agent, Susanna Lee. Either our loved ones will begrudge us, or they will hold on to this wonderful memory and love us for sorting everything out. Which one do you want? As soon as Lee sent the book proposal out, publishers eagerly snapped it up. A German editor made an offer after just 4 hours. Lee took it to the 2016 Frankfurt Book Fair, the marketplace for international sales, and sold it to the UK, US, and Australia. It is now being translated into 23 languages. Magnusson lives in an apartment in a large development in the Södermalm neighborhood of Stockholm. She's tall and slender, wearing a striped French sailor-style shirt, faded jeans and trainers, with a gray bob and a long oval-shaped face. Her most striking feature is her large, round, wet blue eyes. She looks healthy and spry and fashionable without trying hard, which fits the image of her as a mellow, slightly kooky, but wise Scandinavian grandma who writes such things such as, maybe grandfather had ladies' underwear in his drawer, and maybe Grandma had a dildo in hers. But what does that matter now? They are no longer among us. If we like them, it really should be nothing for us to worry about. The first thing to note about Magnuson's home is that it is not in any way minimalist. In her living room, there are shelves of hundreds of books and gentle abstract paintings by Magnuson herself on the walls. There are a surprising number of stuffed toys and masks from Asia. Her late husband was Swedish but born in Japan. And the family lived in Singapore and Hong Kong as he moved frequently for work, presumably all of which have passed the making people happy test. The flat is packed with objects of sentimental value that have accrued around an elderly person who once lived in a larger home. It's all cheerful and very, very neat. She has a large collage of family photos hanging in her bedroom. A sister and brother who are both dead, and her husband, who died in his mid-70s. Her book suggests that sorting through photographs is not the place to begin your death cleaning process. Too many memories to get swept up in, and too much sentiment. Better to start with the kitchen. But when it's time to declutter your photos, she advises, be ruthless. One of her points is that if you don't know the names of the people in a photo, feed it to the shredder. Isn't all decluttering about death? I asked Caitlin Doughty, the mortician. It is a little death to give away a keepsake or an item, she agreed. For most people to admit that they should be keeping track of stuff and getting rid of things is extremely threatening to their sense of self and idea as mortal. For many of us, the main way we try to look at death is by not looking at it. My own parents constantly talk about how they want their dead bodies to be dealt with. My mother has gone from wanting her remains to be flushed down the toilet to wanting her corpse fed to dogs. And yet the elaborate plans for death are a way around dealing with it. My father won't even write a will, instead preferring to phone me at odd hours to get me to make solemn promises that after he is gone, I will do or will not do certain things, such as keeping his house in the family, or making sure to invite specific people to his funeral. This highly developed awareness of their own mortality and careful consideration of how to dispose of their remains, combined with a total lack of planning for what happens after the funeral, sometimes feels like my parents' way of ensuring that their large personalities will gently haunt me from the afterlife. Or to put it more politely, it seems like a way to guarantee their presence in my life as long as possible. But I also sympathize with them. Both of my parents are 66 and will hopefully be around for some time. Dealing with one's own legacy is a stark business. It involves accepting that you are the one who cares most, or perhaps the only person who cares at all about your own legacy. At the same time, it means confronting hard questions about the people you will leave behind. Will your last gift to your loved ones be to leave them a few valuable possessions, or a photo album full of memories, or simply the great favor of not burdening them with having to sort through all the stuff you accumulated over your lifetime? The idea of death as a solo journey is redolent of the language of wellness. The way people talk about getting into their fitness or diet or mindfulness routines. This new view of death borrows heavily from another trendy concept, self-care. The idea that looking after oneself is a political act, shoring yourself up to be able to keep fighting and facing the world. Self-care, too, has been co-opted to be about treating yourself to bath products, massages, face masks, and yoga retreats, granting yourself an excuse to make it okay to buy stuff. The commercialization of death is the inevitable sequel to the monetization of every other aspect of life. Death cleaning is possibly more potent than other well-being trends in that it taps into deep emotions. Fear, guilt, regret. The death industry exploits people's fears of inadequacy. You can't just die. At the very least, you'll need to invest in a house tidying consultant, a death doula, even an environmentally sound bespoke shroud to prove just how well you lived. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in The Guardian. Read one of the obituaries this week. The Frasier star who found fame late in life, John Mahoney, 1940 to 2018. John Mahoney was a late bloomer, the Tony Award-winning performer best known for playing Kelsey Grammer's crotchety, kind-hearted father on the sitcom Frasier, didn't start acting until age 37. Unhappy in his job as the editor of a medical journal, Mahoney began taking acting classes at Chicago's St. Nicholas Theater. There he caught the eye of the young John Malkovich, then an unknown actor who invited him to join the Steppenwolf Theater Company in 1979. Still in its infancy, Steppenwolf desperately needed older actors to fill out its ensemble of up-and-coming performers. By the time I started my career, most people had given up and started selling insurance, Mahoney said. I didn't have so much competition. Mahoney was born in the northern English city of Blackpool to a baker and his homemaker wife, said The Guardian. A 1951 trip to Illinois, where his sister had settled with an American sailor, made such an impression on him that he returned 8 years later under her sponsorship. Mahoney earned his citizenship by serving in the U.S. Army, then worked as a teacher and medical writer. He appeared in dozens of Steppenwolf productions before achieving any kind of national notoriety, said the New York Times. In 1986, he won a Tony Award for his Broadway debut in The House of Blue Leaves, playing a zookeeper with dreams of being a songwriter. A string of film roles followed, including a memorable turn as an alcoholic professor in 1987's Moonstruck. In 1992, appearance on Cheers, the sitcom that included Grammer as the pompous psychiatrist Frasier Crane, set Mahoney on the path to TV stardom, said the Washington Post. When Frasier was spun off in 1993, Grammer pleaded with Mahoney to join the cast. As Marty Crane, a retired cop who moves into Frasier's she-she Seattle apartment with his patched-up recliner and feisty terrier, Mahoney often supplied a dose of plain-spoken wisdom that punctured his son's cultural pretensions. He earned two Emmy nominations for Best Supporting Actor during the show's 11-season run. But Mahoney never relished fame and spent as much time as possible back in Chicago. I could walk to all sorts of good places, he said, the restaurants in his Oak Park neighborhood, where the waiters and waitresses don't want me to read their screenplays. We'll pick up just one of the health and science articles and then just roll right into the talking points page. The invasion of the mutant clone crayfish. An all-female species of mutant crayfish that can reproduce without mating is taking over lakes and rivers around the world. The marbled crayfish first came to scientists' attention in the 1990s when a German aquarium owner bought a bag of Texas crayfish from an American pet trader and found his tank suddenly filling up with the creatures. Researchers discovered that the baby crayfish were all females and that the species was reproducing through cloning. The self-replicating crayfish weren't confined to aquariums, reports NationalGeographic.com. Dumped in the wild by their owners, the creatures thrived in freshwater ecosystems in countries as diverse as Germany, Japan, in Madagascar, where they are displacing native crayfish. A team of scientists has now sequenced the creatures' genomes and discovered that a sex cell mutation in a single slough crayfish, a species native to Florida and Georgia, likely created the marbled crayfish some 25 years ago. When that mutant crayfish mated, it produced a female with three sets of chromosomes instead of the usual two, one inherited from each parent. The first marble crayfish was able to make clones of itself with eggs unfertilized by sperm, a trick that has helped the species reproduce rapidly and spread across the planet. That one animal founded the whole species, said study co-author Wolfgang Stein, and now we have billions worldwide. And on the Talking Points page, SpaceX aiming for Mars. The new space age has begun, said Gene Seymour in CNN.com. SpaceX, the private company owned by tech billionaire Elon Musk, last week successfully launched a Falcon Heavy rocket from Cape Canaveral as a first step toward an eventual Mars mission. The Falcon Heavy can carry 140,000 pounds, more than any other rocket operating today. Its first payload, a cherry red sports car manufactured by Musk's other multi-billion dollar company, Tesla. Sitting behind the wheel of the 2008 Roadster was a spacesuit-clad mannequin dubbed Starman. On the stereo, David Bowie's Space Oddity. The choice of cargo reflects Musk's marketing genius, says Matthew Cottonetti in NationalReview.com. But this launch was much more than a stunt. In this new era, risk-taking buccaneers like Musk may seize space exploration away from slow-moving, underfunded NASA. The president of the Mars Society, Robert Zubrin, captured the excitement of all space enthusiasts when he said, "Mars is now within reach." What sets SpaceX apart is reusability, said Mark Whittington in TheHill.com. Because the company's boosters are designed to return to Earth, they can be used over and over again. This sharply reduces costs. SpaceX charges just $90 million for a Falcon Heavy launch, about a quarter of its nearest rival's lowest price. Musk is already focusing on developing even bigger rockets with the aim of sending people back to the moon and then to Mars, said Kenneth Chang in the New York Times. SpaceX's next-generation rocket, a massive beast capable of carrying 150 metric tons, is the next step in that process. The BFR, the B stands for big, the R for rocket, may be ready to launch in 2022. Musk isn't the only one aiming high, said Marcelo Gleiser in NPR.org. Blue Origin, a firm run by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, is developing its own heavy lifter, while NASA is working on a system dedicated to deep space exploration, including crewed flights to Mars. Three cheers to them all, said David French in NationalReview.com. After the first space race died down, America's aspirations for exploration diminished. Our eyes weren't cast up to the heaven, but down on our phones. But great nations need great accomplishments, not just new consumer products. Thanks to this new private sector-driven space race, we can once again dream of flying higher, faster, and farther than ever before. The military. Why Trump wants a parade? Well, of course the president who claimed bone spurs to dodge the Vietnam War wants the biggest, bestest military parade ever, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. President Trump, apparently envious of France's Bastille Day parade, has ordered the nation's highest-ranking military leaders to start making plans for a grand procession of tanks, missiles, and marching soldiers down Pennsylvania Avenue. It was probably inevitable. Trump, a narcissistic authoritarian who openly admires the world's dictatorial strongmen, no doubt envisions a display of military might like the parades we used to see file past the Kremlin reviewing stand in the days of the Soviet Union. But not a soul on earth doubts the overwhelming strength of the U.S. military. A parade would serve only Trump's insecure ego, as tens of thousands of soldiers, generals, and spectators saluted their preening commander-in-chief. Why not have a parade, asked David French in NationalReview.com. Over the past 17 years, our armed forces have destroyed ISIS's caliphate, toppled the Taliban, deposed Saddam, defeated follow-on al-Qaeda insurgency, and critically, kept us safe from another 9/11-style attack. Nevertheless, it's been almost 30 years since our last national military parade, which celebrated America's victory in the Gulf War. Whatever Trump's motives, our men and women in uniform deserve to be celebrated. After World War II and other wars, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com, the U.S. held military parades without becoming a dictatorship. Liberal hysteria merely plays into Trump's culture war strategy for riling up his base. Just imagine a protester in a pussy hat and a Tiananmen Square-style standoff with an M1 Abrams tank. By all means, let's honor America's military men and women, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. But there are better ways to support our service members than a big, pointless, militaristic display designed to make Trump feel powerful. Mr. President, if you want to show respect for our military, make the Veterans Affairs Department work. I'm willing to give Trump his parade under one condition, said Steve Chapman. Parade should involve only troops who are coming home for good. Americans once used grand military parades to celebrate wars ending. Let's bring that tradition back. With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to join us again next time. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Please give us a call, 919-832-5138.